Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to a special edition episode, Uncovering Gangs and the Trauma of Crime, with James Fisher. There are many cases among the almost 200 episodes on True Crime South Africa now that include some elements of gang involvement. Whether it's just that the offender was once a gang member to some extent, or the crime itself is truly gang-related. It's a scourge that has affected far too many people in countless ways. I've chatted with experts about gangs before. One episode about the Numbers prison gang with Dr. Lisa Krobler was one of the most enlightening I've ever done. And I'm also keen to share what I know about gangs, especially in the Western Cape, where gangsterism presents the biggest problem and accounts for so many senseless deaths. It's always interesting to me to see how ordinary citizens who haven't really been exposed to the truth around gangs react when they learn some of these hard truths. Gangsterism has recently become a hot topic again. Technically, it should always have been. But there's been a terrifying surge in deaths, and the annual crime statistics showing areas in the Western Cape way up in the number of murders in their jurisdictions, as well as a few other incidents, means that a lot of people are talking about gangsterism again. Today I'm not talking to someone you'd generally coin as an expert in gangsterism. But if I've learned anything over the last few years through my own journey of learning and research, it's that when you create a piece of content, whether it's a book or a podcast or anything else about a topic you aren't academically qualified in, you tend to put a lot more research in than you probably need to. And you do become pretty darn knowledgeable in certain fields. James Fisher will introduce himself in a minute, but I will tell you that, among other things, he is an author and has recently published a fiction book called Grey, which tells the story of a man who, by no fault of his own, becomes drawn into the world of gangs. I'm a crime fiction fan, and I often connect with and chat to crime fiction authors. Sometimes they approach me for advice or to be connected with resources. James didn't do either of those, but we did get chatting about his journey into researching gangsterism for his book. We also had a general discussion about gangs as a whole and what might be the next best step to helping the ordinary citizen escape the clutches of these groups. So without further ado, let's get into my conversation with James Fisher.
My name is James Fisher. And I'm a crime writer and a wine journalist. And I just published my third novel. There was a bit of a break in between. So this is a welcome return to the writing world. I took a 10-year break in between. So yeah, this is a fantastic time to get back into the writing seat again. My latest book is called Grey, which is, in a nutshell, is an insurance salesman who loses everybody in his life that is important to him. And as a result, he inherits a lot of money. And then when he finds out that all the people that he's lost in his life was because of a rivaling gang feud, he's got a decision to make. His white hot anger wants him to take revenge. But as we all know, revenge is never really black or white. You know, certain things that you need to ask yourself before you take revenge, as we've picked up in Count of Monte Cristo or any of these classic tales of revenge. It's never a clean cut thing. So yeah, that is in a nutshell what the book is about. But what I really also wanted to focus on is, and this is how we come to the true crime aspect, is the consequences of crime in a normal neighborhood. And I mean, you know, normal can be debated, but just the consequences of crime. So there's a couple of things that happened at the same time. One of the things, while I was working as a content manager for an international outsourcing company, they had a footprint in the Philippines. And while I was there, I saw a study that was done in the Philippines. It was some other disaster that took place, some other weather situation that caused everybody to be removed from the one neighborhood. The entire area was flattened and they had to set up a new neighborhood, which sounds terrible. But I mean, in reality, this is what the government had to do. They had to really shift the people to another spot. And then they took the opportunity to do a study on what happens. And they immediately saw crime spike as they moved from the one place to the other place. Everybody didn't have any money. And obviously, the impoverished community immediately resulted to crime. And the consequences of this was just, it was well documented. It was a very interesting study. There were so many elements of it that spoke to me. That I began playing with the idea of the innocence, which was initially what the book was going to be called, the innocence, you know, the consequences of crime on the innocent people in a neighborhood or in a particular setting. And I've always looked at the gangsterism in Cape Town specifically as a sort of like a hotbed. If you look at the consequences of crime or just crime in general, it's like a hotbed because there are so many things that are happening in that small space that it's something that you really want to open up. As a crime writer, it's something that I really wanted to open up and unbox. My first novel did take a look at the drug industry in Cape Town. That was a Jackhanger. It did already go into the space because I was a Kirby salesman donkey years ago, and I was literally working in Athlone, Gatesville, Grassy Park. You know, I was working in that area. And it was right about the time, 1997, thereabouts, that was around about the time that the movement, the Pagat movement, the people against gangsterism and drugs, they started sort of revolting against the gangs. They were sort of having their own little kickback. And in the process, they ended up killing the one brother, the one Stachy brother, which was the leader of the one gang. And I was selling Kirby's in the middle of all of this, and it was chaotic. Like, you would hear gunshots go off like two streets over, and you go, holy crap, what's happening? And they would say, no, don't worry, that's two streets away. And I thought, like, oh, this type of lifestyle is crazy. I mean, how can you just, you know, be okay to live in this environment? And obviously, my crime mind kept poking at it, as I'm sure you do as well when you're looking at the next project that you're doing. You keep unpacking. And it became clear about this large amount of money that's involved, the drug dealing, even human trafficking. There's so many ties, theft and all these things that all tie in to these criminal organizations going at each other. And it's not the same as the mafia in America, where they would be a little bit more organized. We've got open gunplay happening on a daily basis. So yeah, that is sort of where I came with Gray. And I started unpacking some of the statistics. And the more I unpacked it, the more shocking it became. And that is what I wanted to bring across in the book.
What James mentioned there about the study in the Philippines around the relocated community, of course, matches up directly with what we know about how gang culture really started booming in the Western Cape. When the Group Areas Act forced people of colour out of what the government had deemed white areas and into areas that are now the Cape Flats and surrounds, we essentially had entire communities of people suddenly taken from the only homes they had ever known and thrust into new settlements, where they had to now form a new community based solely on the colour of their skin. These communities were also purposely placed far away from areas that the government wanted to keep white only. New residents had very little money, barely knew the people they were now suddenly living in this new terrain with, and everyone was vulnerable. And so, gangs began to emerge, which took advantage of this vulnerability and established themselves as the kings of the street. At first, as community leaders in disguise, and eventually, very clearly, as criminals.
Absolutely. You hit the nail 100% on the head. I think that was that revelation that actually spurred me on to take a further look, because there was the synergy between this study and what we have come to know as a Capetonian. You know where this all started. You know how it started. But I mean, also, you know, there's so many little pockets to unpack. One of the other pockets to really open up on is, if we're looking at the initiation stages of gangs, I mean, anything from between 8 to 12, you're going to get initiated. You're going to be exposed to this lifestyle, and you're not going to have a lot of choice. It's an uphill battle if you don't choose one way or the other way. And even for women in the area, I mean, they really don't have much say in this matter. It's like a 95% male-driven crime enterprise, which for me was rather shocking, because the people that suffer the most would probably be women and children. And yet children don't have much choice in being initiated, and the women are completely excluded from what's happening. So you've got, I mean, it was very difficult to write that, though, because in my book, I had to bring in a character that was completely oblivious to what was going on around him. And people say, oh, but how can you be oblivious? It is very easy. We blind ourselves to things that's happening around us. So I had to write this character that was completely oblivious, living in... I shifted everything up from the southern suburbs of Cape Town to the northern suburbs to envision the sort of cancer of it all moving up, you know, to sort of broader terrain. But you have this character living in Bellville, a suburb of Cape Town, and you've got these two gangs battling it out, and he gets caught in the middle. But he loses all his loved ones. And that is sort of the sensitive point of it all, because decisions are being made, people are getting hurt, and at the end of the day, they're not given much choice in what's happening. So I had to write a story that's basically almost like, you know, male toxicity that's sort of on display for everybody to see, but that is in reality what's really happening there.
Oblivious is a beautifully descriptive word and very appropriate. I think before I moved to Cape Town a decade ago, I was certainly oblivious to any of this happening. Johannesburg has a different type of crime. It's difficult to explain unless you've lived in both places. And you can certainly live in a bubble in Cape Town and pretend that gang crimes don't exist if you don't live in areas that are mostly affected. But if you pay even a small amount of attention to the news and talk to those around you, it's impossible to miss the deep impact gangsterism has on communities. Certainly with the work I started doing a few years after I moved here, I became very familiar with the problem. And sometimes I wonder whether that level of obliviousness is not perhaps a major part of the problem. If you don't think something is an issue, either because you don't know it exists or because you think it doesn't directly affect you, you're far less likely to stand against the problem or make decisions that will help to affect change. Far too often when I see articles posted online about gang-related shootings and deaths, in the comments I find people saying things like, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. And I know that's a way for people to make themselves feel better about death, when they can convince themselves someone deserved to die. But when you actually read the article or do some digging, you may realize very quickly that many of the deaths related to gangsterism are not of gangsters. They are innocent members of the public caught in the crossfire. In my previous life, I worked with a young lady whose brother was shot and killed in their neighborhood because he wore the wrong color jacket on the wrong street, and he was mistaken for a gang member. He was not a gang member. He never had been. He was an ordinary young man who had just matriculated and started studying a tertiary qualification to build a life for himself. And that is just one of thousands of similar stories. And then there are people who lose their lives or are forever traumatized through crimes committed by individuals involved in gangs who have learned their level of violence through their connections with some of the most cold-blooded individuals in our country. Gang violence does not just affect gang members. Its deepest effects are felt in the lives and the homes of ordinary South African citizens.
Absolutely. I think the latest stats that I looked at was something like 20% of the fatalities are people who were completely unaffiliated, not involved at all. You know, they had absolutely no involvement at all. And they were just, there was also, now the other, there was a recent flare up where there was like, I think there was, I don't know, 56 people that died in a 6-day period. So, I mean, this is really what the book is about, like a flare up like that. You know, this is literally two gangs are just having a bit of a tiff. And they don't mind open gunplay. You know, they don't have, it's not really organized in that way. There are big financial drivers at play, sort of like the crime economy on display, but they don't have the thought to really sort of plan their moves better because it just takes place. It's really a toxic mindset. And it's in this environment, this hypothetical environment, where I brought in a Jobian perspective of someone who will suffer at the hands of someone else. So it's in that sense where I got to play my one wild card. So a very wise author once said to me that you've got one card that you can play that is completely unrealistic, unbelievable. Yeah. And you've got to play that one very carefully, because once you've played it, you can't bring in anything else. Unless it is fantasy, you know, fantasy writers have got their own challenges they've got to deal with. But they've got the freedom of doing things and creating worlds that is far from current thought. Where if you're writing a fiction novel, you've got one thing that you can play. And so the one thing that I could play was this person's loss. And yes, it's hypothetically, it's a freak situation where you lose all your loved ones in like a couple of days. But if you're looking at a flare-up where like almost 60 people in the space of a week gets killed, it's not too far-fetched, because of that 60 people, 20% of them were completely innocent. They were completely uninvolved. Yeah. So I used this scenario to be the basis or the backbone of the story that I was writing.
Research is a big part of my life. In fact, it takes up the most time in everything I do. Podcasts, books, all of it. The writing part is relatively simple. In the grand scheme of things, it's the finding of the information that is sometimes difficult. But I write nonfiction, so that stands to reason. And James writes fiction. But if you want to write good, believable fiction, especially in crime, research is vital. I wondered how James had gone about uncovering the information he needed to believably write about this clandestine world of gangs and organized crime.
Well, so as I said, when I was selling Kirby's in 97, I got a really alarming sort of inside look of what was really happening with the whole stuffy shootout. And the whole feeling at the time was sort of intoxicating, because you were exposed to all of these real things that were happening. And it's one of those scenarios that if you come close to it, could potentially start a thought pattern that you'll have to keep at. You'll have to keep tugging at it. I always think it's like if you have a jersey or a cardigan and there's a little piece that's loose and you keep pulling at it, before long you've got the whole thing pulled out. So I think with any writer, it's like that. You get this little piece that you get attached to and you keep on tugging at it. And my research went in various ways. The next book I'm working on deals quite intimately with the radial community. Okay. So the radial community is in Simonstown. So when we think about the act that took people away and repositioned them somewhere else, as you just mentioned now, we always think about District 6. But we forget about all the other places. One of the places that we forget about is the radial community that was in Simonstown. Now, we clearly forget about it because it was a peaceful evacuation. They were forced. It was a forced evacuation, but it was peaceful. There wasn't any altercation. It's amazing that it happened in a peaceful way. But the consequences of that is that people were then relocated to different areas. Even when I was researching this book, so this is something I wrote, I initially wrote the large part of this book in 2012, 2013, 2014, and it's been sort of lying there for so long. I did finish it now recently, but that research also, that was lying there. All of these little bits of research was always lying there, and in typical writer style, you let it marinate, and then eventually something just clicks into place, and you go like, damn, there's something here. There's extensive thought on something. So the research is there. You just have to start asking the right questions. It comes out in little drips and drabs, mostly exposed through good journalism. But I couldn't always rely on government stats because it's not the most accurate. Here I say, I'm so sorry, but I find that the stats that you get from government aren't always 100% accurate. You've got to follow it intensely, what happens, like how things get recorded. But anyway, at the end of the day, I was able to go through this large mass of information. And I treat carefully the novel because I don't go for political debate. A good writer asks questions, pose questions. We posit ideas. We create thought. We stimulate thought. And that is the best thing that we can do. And hopefully people see the truth through that. So I hope I took all this information together, and I hope I was able to position a type of truth there that can get people out of their comfort zones and let them ask these questions, these maybe tough questions, like what's really happening in my environment? What's happening around me? What am I not seeing?
Long-time listeners might remember a conversation I had with retired Scotland Yard detective Steve Keogh on the podcast some years ago. One of the first murders he ever investigated as a Scotland Yard detective was a gang crime in which a minor died from stabbing. And he and I chatted about the difference in gangs between the United Kingdom and South Africa. He said that most street gangs in the UK are youngsters, teenagers and young men in their very early 20s, and their weapon of choice is very often a knife. Knife crimes in general are much more common in the UK than gun crimes, and as a result, their police officers, doctors, and forensic pathologists have become some of the most experienced in the world at the types of injuries that knives can inflict, and how to treat them when possible. On the other end of the spectrum, I told him about how our gangs are often also younger men, but many of the members move in and out of prison and remain in the gangs for life. We've also got the added complication of having the Numbers prison gang, of course, which have an impact on street gangs too. And our gang members' weapon of choice is more often than not a gun. You'll also know from previous coverage on True Crime South Africa that much of the initial arming of our gangs happened as a result of a few corrupt police officers. Our street gangs are also a lot more organized than those in the UK. There, very often, it's just a bunch of young men who are friends and decide to start protecting their streets or committing petty crimes to get money. Like in South Africa, the vast majority of these gangs start in areas that are poverty-stricken and where youth are looking for something to belong to or a way to make money. But Keogh was most horrified at the idea that our police officers are always armed with a firearm, because there's a very good chance that a suspect you approach will also be armed. In the UK, only certain police officers are trained to use firearms and carry them. Those units are called in particularly dangerous situations, but most police officers go into calls unarmed, except for non-lethal weapons like tasers.
And I think it's very easy to lose perspective, or at least to lose sight of the extent of it. I mean, South Africa, if you're looking at some of these areas where gun violence is really prevalent, it is comparable to active conflict areas. And I think when it's one of those statements that you make where people go like, oh, really? So what you want to compare this to? If you're looking at the homicide rate, the murder rate, it really is comparable to war zones. And this is a normal neighborhood where people are living. And you've got a war taking place around you. I mean, what I think Cape Town alone saw like 3,500 murders in 2024. That's one of the world's most lethal cities. I think it's the second highest in South Africa and the 16th highest globally. So wherever you're living in Cape Town, something is happening around you. You must be aware of that. And I think that that's something that we maybe don't always open our eyes to, or it's very easy to put your head in the sand. I mean, I think we're somehow all guilty of that sometimes, but I wanted to bring that to the front. I wanted to bring that into stark focus by just showing what would happen to someone when he experiences that loss all around him and he starts just opening his eyes a bit. Obviously, in the book, I deal with the idea of revenge because, I mean, revenge is such a common theme in writing. I mean, we all understand it. We all get angry. We all get mad. But a little rhyme go by, is it Mr. Robinson? What do we do with the mad that we feel? So, sorry, I've got three kids, so I end up
Yeah,
being.
I know what you mean.
So it became to me this question of what do you do with the mad that you feel? I mean, how is he going to deal with this? At the end of the day, it was something akin to Count of Monte Cristo meets Fight Club.
The more I do this work, the more I realize that some stories and some concepts, despite being very real, are actually best brought across in fiction. There's something about presenting a story in fiction, allowing readers to use their imagination and, to an extent, to disconnect from the reality of the world, that can often do the opposite and help to convey the truth of a situation. Non-fiction can sometimes build a wall where, when we're too focused on these things being very real stories, we don't allow our minds to go to the places they need to go in order to fully appreciate all sides of a complex story. There are many stories I've come across in the last 6 years that I think can only really be told as fiction.
You get away with it a lot more in fiction, but besides being able to get away with a lot of things in a fictional setting, I think you can also bring it to fruit. You can give it its worst case scenario, which I think we should do more often because therein lies our ability to apply reasoning, to sort of look at the situation and to look for solutions, to look for ways that we can deal with this conflict better. So, where you would have just a normal situation take place, you can amplify that or expound on that and make it even so much more worse and challenge the character so much more. I mean, I was absolutely cruel to this character. I really made him suffer a lot. And the reason for that was to bring it to its fruit.
James's book is heavily built on the theme of revenge. And I think that's something that comes up a lot in the work I do too, and in the public response to crime. We might not frame it as revenge. Sometimes we frame it as justice or just desserts. You know, that live by the sword, die by the sword thing. But it's certainly on the revenge spectrum, in my opinion, at least. And I think we so seldom see true justice in the world that when we read about even fictionalized situations where people do mete out what it seems the bad guys deserve, we get a little rush from that. It feels like the world has balanced out somewhat, even if it's a fictional world, and even if it's just for a little while. I also think that we can all relate to how powerful a driver revenge can be, although perhaps not the healthiest, but powerful all the same.
Yeah, I really wanted to delve into the psychological toll of grief and vengeance, and these are going to play off. So in so many ways, if you're looking at the title of the book, it's not a misspelling. The character's name is Gray, G-R-A-Y. So I often get people asking me, oh, did you make a mistake in the spelling? It's reason for that is because the character's name is Gray. But I do play with the theme or the color theme Gray throughout the whole book, because he is in this gray space where he's got to make difficult decisions and he's got to review his own life, you know, given what happened and how he takes steps to sort of avenge his family, but at the same time, do it in a way that makes sense to him in his current gray state of mind. That was fun to explore. So it was a lot of challenging writing.
I talk to the family members of those who have lost loved ones to murder a lot. And there's one common theme I've picked up in many of the family members. Almost all of them have had some thoughts of revenge against the killer. And not just vague thoughts either. Some had actual plans of how they were going to kill the person who had killed their loved one. Very specific plans, which they either didn't end up going through with because they realized it would just make things worse for the rest of their family, or because something happened to set their plan off course. And they changed their minds after that. One man, after we chatted for about an hour about his partner who was gunned down in her vehicle, confessed to me that he'd developed a plan to kill the man who he knew had killed his partner. The only thing that had stopped him, he said, was that he felt like that would make him no better than the person he so despised. Although he'd already decided not to carry out this plan, he told me that the idea of having been in that mindset, where if the killer was standing in front of him, he would most certainly have tried to take his life, bothered him immensely, long after he'd dismissed the idea. I listened, and then I told him I wasn't sure if this would be helpful to him, but I could tell him that he was not the first person to tell me that. In fact, he wasn't even the second or the third. I explained to him that countless family members of the murdered had had that very thought. And some had even, like him, had concrete plans about how and when they would do it. The relief on his face was an incredible sight. He suddenly realized that his thoughts and feelings were completely normal, and they were often part of the grief cycle. And I told him that, although I'm certainly no psychologist, in my opinion, the fact that he was able to move through those thoughts himself and not become fixated on them was proof that he would be okay at some point. And that's no. He most definitely was not like the man who had killed his partner.
And I can sense in the way that you're talking now that all of your writing, you have really experienced that type of truth as well so many times, because it gave me goosebumps now, because I deal with this very thing, this very, very sensitive topic of I am now becoming just as bad as the people that did this to me. In the book, I detail exactly how he goes to consult or hire a hitman to help him. I do try to give it a slightly, not so satirical, but I do give it a slight humorous slant, which, I mean, this came about while I was doing my master's degree. I was playing around with this type of writing style because it's almost so depressing to go into this situation of someone becoming so bitter that you have to give it a slightly humorous perspective just to completely understand what is happening in this person. And it's not so much humorous, just more realistic, but from a distance, so people can get to be the fly on the wall. Anyway, he gets himself a hitman to help him with revenge. And again, the scenario plays out just as he did not think it would play out. Because in life, very few things happen the way that we think it's going to happen. Even when you start off on the path of revenge, it's probably not going to end the way that you think it's going to happen. You know, it's nice to watch movies and see it play out the way they did. But the thing is, you are essentially also becoming a criminal. And you need to understand how rotten are you prepared to become. I mean, and you become so rotten that you basically counter all the good that you were trying to do by taking this person out. So, yes, I did very much play on that approach as well. And I hope I captured it. I love character arcs. I'm absolutely obsessed with character arcs and with meaty characters. So I really tried my best to expand on this character and to make it feasible as possible. One of the other elements that I dealt with in this story, which is maybe not related to crime, though I'm sure there is a line to tug on, is the money that he inherits when his loved ones pass away as well. Now he has been empowered to take matters into his own hand. If money is not a problem, you know, revenge is a stone's throw away. I mean, if we look at like Ani Dhawani situation, that was, how much does it cost to put a hit on someone? It's not a lot of money,
no.
Which is very scary. Yeah. And it's even more scary that we talk about it so openly. How much does it cost to buy a gun in South Africa? It's really not a lot of money. And it's not difficult to come by. And it's scary that we talk like this, you know, and it's those types of things that I bring to light, where one character buys a gun very easily. It's not difficult to do. And where he basically hires a hitman. These things are super scary ideas to focus on. And I think in your true crime research that you've been through, you've encountered that so many times, I'm sure. You don't have to be too organized. You just have to be slightly well funded, and then you can do whatever you want, but there's consequences.
As I'm putting together this podcast, I'm reading a headline about a high profile hit that is alleged to have been arranged for 7,000 rand, and that is not an isolated case. You will have heard many cases I've covered where people have carried out hits for far less than that. Of course, these are not professional hitmen, and that's precisely why we know about the cases, because they're usually doing it for the first time and leave a whole range of clues behind in their wake, or they can't keep to themselves and they tell someone.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's just so true, so 100% true. And I mean, even that is putting value on a life. I mean, you know, never mind where we should be. If you look at where we are currently, the lack of placing any value on a life, how cheap a life is at the moment, is shocking. I mean, we have really stepped out of it. And if we look at the way that gangsterism has evolved in the last 30 years and grown, it's gotten to a point now where I'm wondering what the future will be. How are we going to step back from it? Because 30 years is a long time to be in that environment. It's growing up in the war zone. You become a different person. You become seared. I mean, you've got your emotional values, your beliefs, your faith in people. I mean, you come out there scarred. So how do we change that? How do we affect change?
This past week, I had the great honor of being invited to participate in the Cape Flats Book Festival. My participation had two legs. The first was being part of a roadshow where I got to chat with learners at Portland High School in Mitchell's Plain about my journey as a podcaster and writer. And the second leg was the festival itself, which was held this past weekend and brought together a huge number of authors to promote reading and discussions around a wide range of topics. It was honestly one of the most impactful book festivals I've ever been a part of. At Portland High, some of the learners came to chat with me after my talk, and we spoke about their experiences with crime on the Cape Flats, and what it's been like for them to grow up so frequently witnessing violence. Some expressed the concern that this had made them desensitized to death and violence, and they wondered out loud how that might have changed them as people. Others asked about identifying signs in their friends, which might indicate they were going to become criminals, and what they could do to help. I answered all of their questions as honestly as I could, drawing on the experiences I've had over the last 6 years, and doing my best to reassure them that while their fears were valid, and they should never have had to experience this, the fact that they could voice these concerns and verbalize them meant that they could also overcome any damage that had been done. It's probably the most honest and raw conversation I've ever had after a book event, and it felt like there was this collective holding of breath until the reassurance came that they were not irrevocably scarred and that there was always hope. Those children know more about the realities of crime than I will ever know. It's woven into the fabric of their lives, and it was an incredible privilege to be a sounding board for their fears for that brief moment. Their amazing insights into life and death and violence stunned me. And honestly, if that group of young people is anything to go by, there is significant hope for our future as South Africans. But we cannot keep doing this to them. We must find a way to change their reality without delay. And James hopes that his literary take on what can happen when gangsterism is allowed to thrive could help to show the reality to a wider audience.
And we need to, this is now where my poetic side is calling on the good side of people, and we live in this place of hope that we will change, hope that we will see what's going on. And as a writer, if we can bring those ideas to someone's doorstep and we make it personal in a story, and you showcase what's really going on, maybe that can be a way of affecting change. If I can at the very least touch someone with a book and say, okay, maybe we need to just be mindful of what's really going on, and if it can touch someone in that regard, then I think my job as a writer has been done.
I've had the opportunity to read Grey, and it is definitely a book I highly recommend. Grey is available in all bookstores and on Amazon. And for more information on the book or the author, you can head over to his website on jamesfichet.com. I also recommend following him on social media to keep up with the events he's doing around the book, which are very creative and really interesting. A huge thank you to James for joining me today for this discussion.